Tell me I'm an alcoholic. I am juiced. Not literally. I am really excited to be here. Boy, what a day. What a day. I am the official... That's interesting. I've been tripping on this for a couple days. That I am the official Friday night speaker for the Saturday Night Live group of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm the out-of-town speaker. And, you know, I got sober in this room. Not this room. But through the group, Saturday Night Live. And this is like the... That was 11 years ago. And my husband and I moved to San Diego about 3.5-4 months ago. And we are moving back a week from Sunday. So it's like they caught me, right? This is like the only time I'm going to be the out-of-town speaker for my hometown. It's awesome. You know, and I woke up this morning, and I shared this at a new meeting today. I woke up this morning, and I wanted to call in sick for this thing tonight. Because, you know, it's funny. I don't feel like I am the epitome of health and recovery these days. Thank you. I was concerned that I'd get up here and spread the disease instead of the solution. But you know what I can do tonight, and I'm real clear on this. God and I are real clear on this, is I can be an example to you of how you don't take something when it gets real. And folks, it gets real here. And how you keep trudging forward no matter what. No matter what. You know? Because that's where I'm at today. I'm so grateful that we have the opportunity, that I have the opportunity to come home. Okay? One of the things that I have learned through my experience in the last 4 months is that I have something very valuable here that God and I went to work on a little over 11 years ago, and that was to build a home. And I don't know about you, but I didn't have a home. I didn't have a place to call home before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, specifically Saturday Night Live group of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's one of the greatest blessings that I know that I have in my life. It's neat to look around the rooms. There are a few people that I know in this room tonight. 11 years ago, there was a lot more people. The faces have changed. But the few people I can look around the room, the back of the room, you know. And the sides, you know, when I got sober, we had a counter that all the real sober people sat on at 6 o'clock and at noon, you know, and at 8 o'clock. But what I also can see is, you know, I love drunks. I love drunks, whether they're drunk or they're sober, because I do believe that we are not bad people trying to get good. You know, that we're sick people trying to get better. And I see, you know, the suffering, you know, that goes on out there. And I have compassion for drunks. And I have a special appreciation and a bond with them. What's even greater is that I can come in here, you know, and see us after God's intervened. And we've had that brief period where their choices returned on a daily basis. And then I see the desperation to get sober and to change our lives. And man, I love that. My life is about that today. So anyways, I don't know where we're going to go from here. I turned it over to God. I figure, okay, now it's yours. I made the plane. I was a cattle call on Southwest today. I was my husband gets there and he gets numbers 1 through 30. If you guys are familiar with taking trips on Southwest, they break it up 30, 60, 90. I was 130 when I got on the plane today. And so everybody was getting on and I was still going, okay, you got to show up no matter what. And so what I can tell you is my experience, strength, and hope. And today, you know, I have a lot to be grateful for in my life. And I didn't know that at 11 o'clock this morning when I got on that plane. I wasn't there. It's amazing what happens when you don't take anything, no matter what. What a difference, you know, one day at a time makes. And I guess I'll back it up a little bit and let you know that I walked in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, Saturday Night Live meeting, at noon, July 23rd, 1987. I was 18 years old, and it was the first day and the first time that I had ever heard the words Alcoholics Anonymous, much less ever been to a meeting. No card slip, no recovery house, no intervention, no adolescent rehab unit, no aftercare. I was taken to a new meeting at Saturday Night Live, and I've been here ever since. I fell in love with this program. I am one of those people. So if I make you sick, oh well. If I, you know, what I hope is that maybe you can see a little bit about, you know, it's an awesome thing to have a solution. I wasn't really caught up. When I got here and people said, you know, 18, I was just talking to a girl this afternoon about getting here young. And, you know, when I got here, the way that the people in my life responded was, you can't be an alcoholic. Look at how young you are. You know, you don't even know yourself yet, you know. And my family certainly didn't want me in here. My family's riddled with this disease. This disease has torn my family up to the point where we don't even talk. This is my family. This is what I have today. And I'm grateful for that. But, you know, when I got here, people, on the other hand, you know, that were in the rooms, they thought it was really, today they look at me and they think it's a real novel thing that I got here so young. And I'm quick to tell them, you know, that I didn't get here because it was so good. I got here because at 18 years old, it was that bad. I was ready. I was as desperate as we say the dying can be. I was looking at this. When I got here, after this guy up here reminded, if you want to see what Tammy looked like when she got into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, not only drinking, you know, drugs are a part of my story, you know, I call it, you know, appetizers, you know. And what brought me to my bottom was dropping LSD on a daily basis. When I hooked up, you see, I'm gonna bounce all over the place, but I'll get it out eventually. I've never been afraid of the whole concept of God. The word never scared me. The idea never scared me. I actually was seeking. I didn't know it was God, but I was seeking something. From a very young age, what it was like in my family, you know, was there was a lot of insanity. I was born into a war zone, and I had to survive. So at that point, I started looking for things to help me to do that, you know, survival skills that would work for me. That became my design for living that worked. That kept me alive. Those skills look something like this. See if you can relate. You don't let people know that you don't know the answers. You just make something up. Some of the rules I played, some of the other rules I played by was, you don't ask for help. You have to get for yourself out there. And you don't let your guard down. You don't show weakness. You know, you gotta be tough, you know. And that's kind of what I ran with, you know, especially when I wound up on the streets of downtown San Jose. That's exactly what you do. You had to learn to read people. You got, are these people going to help me or hurt me? And you had to determine that by the time they got to you from the end of the block. That's what it looked like when I got here. What it was like, I experienced alcoholism long before I ever picked up the first drink. You know, I experienced a lot of the disease through my mother. She's a big part of my story. She was an alcoholic. She was a young mother. And she was an incredible person with an awesome spirit. Very passionate. She was a singer. And very lost and very empty. And a lot of what it looked like when I was growing up was her coming in and out of my life periodically. You know, she did the best she could. I know that today. And she was a lot of fun. But oftentimes, she would leave my brother and I. I have a brother, Timmy. Timmy and Tammy. She wanted a Timmy and Tammy from the age when she was 15 years old. And she, you know how we are with good alcoholics, you know? We go, self-will. We, you know, so she made things happen. And, she had us by the time she was 18. And shortly after that, she left my father, who was also an alcoholic. He was also a gambler. And she left him in the middle of the night after he had beaten her one more time for fear of her life. And then she went out on her own and off into this disease. And so when she would leave us with relatives or friends, you know, oftentimes she would be going out. It would look like this. I'll see you in the morning. And that would turn into 2-3 days a week, you know. And then sometimes I wouldn't see her for a month. You know, I get the story. Your mom's in the hospital. You know, she's not doing good. And so I grew up in hospitals and in a lot of other people's houses. And when she was home, she would, it's the 70s, it's late 70s, or late 60s, early 70s. You know, we were living in Massachusetts, right outside of Boston. She would come home, or she'd go out to the discos. I remember her, she'd get that black, strappy little dress number on that kind of, you know, when she spun and, you know, going out doing the hustle, I guess, you know, just like, and she would come back, and she would have a different man with her every night. So I saw things at a very young age that you just should not be seeing, you know. And sometimes they'd stay just for the night if she made it home. And sometimes they'd stay a little longer. And what would happen would be eventually the drugs and the alcohol would run out. And they would turn on each other. So by the age of about 8 years old, I had already learned how to pull men off my mother's back. You know, I woke up many times in the middle of the night with the crash of the television. I remember one night one of her exes went through the whole house and just destroyed it. And I woke up and my brother and I came out of our rooms just in time to pull this guy off of her back, off of her, where he had her legs over the top of her head and he was going to break them. And we got in there, and and my brother called the police. And I remember just growing up scared, just terrified, you know. And alcohol was always there. But I didn't know that was the problem, of course. But at that time, what happened, even younger than that, I became her keeper, you know? And that's when I was forced to, you know, give up my childhood and get down to business of, you know, being an adult. Somebody had to take care of Mom. I never really got real resentful at her. I was more like scared that I was going to lose her. So I took on, like, I got to protect her. At 4 years old and 3 years old, I was pulling up the chair to, in the mornings, I would wake up and I'd grab a chair and I'd pull it up, to the kitchen sink and I'd start doing the dishes. 3 and 4 years old, and I'd turn and I'd ask my mom things like this. Now, how are we going to pay the rent? How many four-year-olds do you know that do this? I remember at that age, I as young as that age, I used to feel so bad because my mom only had one pair of jeans to wear. Levi bell bottoms, you know, and she only had one pair, and my goal at that time, and she had feet, her feet were just calloused because she worked, you know, and she worked hard. But I just remember those things, and I remember, like saving up my money and buying, you know, I remember buying her a new pair of jeans, you know, and I remember saving up my money and getting her one of those little foot massages that you go, and they put your feet in when you get your little, get your pedicures and everything, just, like, doing everything I could, you know. And I also remember at that time being very clear within myself that when I got big enough, and I got strong enough, I was getting the hell out of there, and I was never looking back. It was a very young age. That's when I began to seek people, places, and things to provide some kind of peace in my life. Now, I didn't achieve that, but that's when I began to seek. We say that the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. Well, what I key in on when it comes to that phrase is a desire. Desire. It is at that age that I began to have that desire for my life to be different. So when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous at 18 years old, And I had to face those people that questioned me as to whether I was an alcoholic or not. As I was telling this young lady today, she's 22 years old. She's got a couple months now. I didn't get into the debate of whether I was an alcoholic or not. My committee would share, you know, we talk about the committee that lies between our ears. Mine would talk to me like this. You haven't even gotten married. What are you gonna do at your wedding when it comes time to toast the champagne? What are you gonna do? Having graduated from college, just the worst. Okay, well, what if your mother dies? Now then, I mean, that's the ultimate tragedy. Then you'd have an excuse to drink. And I was telling her today, I turned to that, you know, and at that time, I just turned to that committee and I said, thank you for sharing. You don't get to vote. And it isn't about that. You know, when I came in here and I saw the way that you were conducting your lives, and I saw that the peace that you had inside, and I saw the love that you showed me, I mean, once I got to a place where I actually trusted that love, it was about doing whatever it took to get that for myself. So when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, very little of it, and very little of it has been for me about drinking or not. It's been about, and it's still about, the quality of my life and how I feel in my skin. And I have graduated from college. I have gotten married. And I have watched my mother die. And none of that is worth giving up the life that I have today. And the reason, you know, I was telling this gal, you know, we think that we give up our fun. You know, that's what my head kept telling me. Well, you know, fun out there before I got sober, like I said, I had hooked up with this gentleman in my life. His name was Uncle Bill. And at that time, I was about to hit rock bottom. I was living on 666 South Fifth Street in downtown San Jose, off an alley down there. And that was my playground, you know. Uncle Bill was 50 years old. I was 17. And he became very important in my life. He dealt LSD, and he would go over the hill in Santa Cruz, come back, and then he'd give me as much as I wanted, and I tested for him because I know today what his intentions were on me, and by the grace of God, they were never realized, you know, but. That's what really sped me to my bottom. I should back up a little bit and let you know that, you know, my first drink, I was 14 years old. I was living in Sonora. I met a girl from Sonora tonight that I owe amends to. I've been looking at her for about 4 years now, and I thought, no, that can't be her. But it is her. I just found out right before the meeting. I introduced myself to her, and I told her, I'm sorry. And she said, for what? And I said, have a seat, and I'll tell you why. I picked up my first drink was a beer. And it was a typical high school kegger, you know? And it was just all about being accepted, you know? Which was what I know a lot of us are into. Here. We want to be accepted. We don't want to be judged. We want to feel safe, you know? And, you know, for me, because of all the responsibilities that I had already in my life, I was a very serious 14-year-old with a lot of problems, you know? Like how to get the rent paid and how to keep my mom here and how to, you know, and how do I grow up in this small town with everybody watching my back? You know, we were on welfare, and people judge you, and, you know, and I got it, you know. So I don't know about how you survived, but I got tough. I got real tough. And I made it about my business not to show other people my business. You know, keep your nose out of my business. That's the whole attitude that I kind of went out and maintained there. And what happened was is I tried to do high school, and it just did not work for me. I remember that a disciplinarian, Miss La Sorenza, every time she'd walk in the room, I would just cringe because I knew who she was coming for every time. And she pulled me into her office one time before she suspended me for, I don't know, about the seventh or eighth time. And she said, I got suspended for smoking dope in the back of the class. I was reported by a student. I never thought about the students. I was more keeping the eye on the teacher. I thought everybody did it. But she said, Tammy, she said, you know, statistically, yellow cars get... red cars get pulled over more than yellow cars, statistically. And she said, my dear, you are a red car. You know, And what she meant, and what I understand that to be is, you know, I didn't know how to deal with what was going on in my life. And all I knew, you know, was that the only relief I found was through drinking. And the only other way that I found at that point to deal with my frustrations were a power greater than myself. My rage and my anger was a power greater than myself. And this is where I get to the amends. What wound up happening, the only way I knew how to deal with high school was to fight. I got suspended more times than not for fighting in high school. And the amends that I owe to this girl in the back of the rooms is that she and I, we crossed paths at a time where I'm sure my life was unmanageable and I was out of control. I used to take pride in how tough I was when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. Now what I feel is the pain that I caused other people and the shame. You know, I've recovered from it. The shame doesn't run my life because I'm grateful that I have another way of living today. But I caused a lot of wreckage out there, you know, and for that I owe her an amends. And what better time to do it? We'll talk after the meeting. But I am grateful today, though, that I can take all that and I can use it as my experience today. Shortly after I got into high school with my mom, her disease took off. And we found her. She started mixing prescription medication, the wrong kind of prescription medication, with alcohol. And rapidly she began to lose her mind. She became mentally unstable. And she began to rage uncontrollably. And that wasn't typical for her. And she became paranoid, highly paranoid. And what little of my family was around tried to get her some help. But in Tuolumne County, you see, at that time, there weren't mentally ill people. The whole system was set up to deny. Kind of reminded me of my family. You know, same thing. Deny. And when it finally came to the end, they checked her into the third story of the general hospital there. That's where they kept all the special people. And she checked herself out and came back home. And I just come home from my first concert, you know, and it was like the Tubes, or I think it was the Tubes. And barely remember it. Yeah, I was drunk. And all the lights were on. It was like 1 o'clock in the morning. All the lights were on, and my brother and she had remarried at that time, my stepfather, they were gone. And I walked in, and she was buck naked, and she was hallucinating, and she was thinking that, you know, these demons were coming after her. And she was slithering on the floor, she said, like a serpent. She said she was trying to explain to me what was coming after her. Anyways, I put her in bed with me, and I called her doctor, and I was told that they couldn't help her unless she was in danger of hurting herself or others. Now, if you've heard that in your life, that it pertained to you, you're in the right place. There is help. But I hung up the phone and actually went to sleep in her bed. And the next morning we woke up, and my stepfather was a pawn shop owner. He was a real winner. And his name was Les, and I thought that was appropriate. We didn't get along too well. He's the only man in my life that ever attempted to spank me. I thought that was sweet. Broke two of his ribs. And he kept a briefcase in the back, in the trunk of the car, and in that briefcase was a was some jewels and a handgun. And I in the night, my mom had gotten herself up out of bed and gotten herself that handgun, and she took herself. We were living about a quarter mile out of the road, off the main road, and Sonora is small and lots of trees and lots of land and everything like that. And she put a bullet through her head. But my family, it wasn't the first suicide attempt in my family. You know, whenever I think about suicide, you know, I just don't think about suicide. She lived through that. We don't, it isn't in our family to get to leave this planet very easily. No. It's about for us to learn our lessons. And, you know, after that, it was like she lived through that. Everybody pretty much left. You know, and so, again, it was she and I. And when, you know, her disease took her to that point, and it was just like she had passed the baton on to me. And I took that baton, you know, the disease of alcoholism, and I ran with it. And it was just about, for me, drinking as much as I could, as often as I could, to kill the pain. You know, and what I know today is we all have our own personal pain from whatever. And I have compassion, you know, for alcoholics, because when they come into the room, when we come into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and we truly have a desire to recover, you know, we get an opportunity to take these steps into our lives and get with someone to show us how to do it. And we get an opportunity to face that pain, walk through it, and see what's on the other side, and heal. Because today, you know, all the things that I had to face growing up, they no longer have the power to destroy my life. They no longer have the power, you know, to force me to pick up that drink, you know, to pick up that drink. I can face anything, you know, and stay sober. But I can't do it alone. And what these steps, you know, gave me was an opportunity to build a relationship with a higher power, with a God of my understanding. And I had been seeking that for a long time. You know, inadvertently, I was seeking that, as I said. And when we were living back east, you know, I had this little hobby of hanging out in empty cathedrals. You see, in Worcester, Massachusetts, back in those days, they would leave these cathedrals open all night. And so when my mom wouldn't come, when my mom wasn't home, I get up out of bed and I get dressed, and I was you know, 8, 9 years old, and I go walk in the streets of Worcester, Massachusetts. It's a city. It's I hit the streets and I go in and out of these cathedrals, and I go in there and no one would be there, and it would be beautiful, just this all this gorgeous felt and red velvet and felt and brass everywhere. And I'd sit and I'd go to the tops of these cathedrals, as far as out, you know, beautiful mahogany wood everywhere. And I'd sit there. And I would just look around and I just remember feeling at peace. You know, and I didn't know what I was seeking at that time specifically. I didn't know what would work. And so what would happen is I'd hang out there for a while, and I'd go back during the day when the services were being held. And I'd meet the people. And my mom always encouraged me to pick whatever path I she was very cool that way. She never, obviously, she couldn't press too much of anything on me. And so she would encourage me, you know, seek whatever works for you, sweetheart. So I'd meet these people, and I'd go back a couple, three times or whatever. And eventually I'd get baptized. Because I figured, you know, I considered baptism like paying your monthly dues. So consequently, you know, I've been baptized probably five different times. I am Catholic. That was the last one. I am Baptist, Protestant. I know I hit a cult at some point there back east. But they were nice people. They were nice people. It was just this little house. I came across these people, and all I know is that they grew herbs in the back, and they knelt, you know, towards the east and prayed three times a day, and they were just sure that there was just going to come this one day. You know, see, I'm a kid. I'm just this kid. Look at me. I just make dinner, homemade dinners, and I never got homemade meals. That was cool. I grew up on welfare cheese. Does anybody relate to that? Yeah. It's great stuff, you know. But, they were just sure that just one day, this thing called Armageddon was going to happen and we'd all be wiped out or something. I don't know. But they let me sleep over and they were nice. But what would happen is eventually these people would start talking to me about the God of their understanding. And they'd start telling me, well, you need to do this and you can't do that and you can't even think about doing this. And I was sitting there and I'm like 8, 9, 10 years old. I'm going, oh my goodness, I've already broken all these rules. I'm going to hell and I haven't even started yet. And so, and the God of their understanding, their God, the God they said I had to believe in, I didn't understand. You know? And I didn't think that I was good enough for their God. So I remember at that time starting to think, you know, this has seemed so good except for these things. And I remember at that time thinking, wouldn't it be nice if there was a place where you got to pick your own God and make up whatever you want and that there weren't any rules and nobody told you. The fastest way, I think, to piss an alcoholic off is to get in their face and say, you need to, and you can finish that however you want, because that's about where I stopped listening. Because I go, no, what you need to do is. But I was still had that desire, you know. So when I got here and I saw, you know, I saw you, I met you, I saw the hookers hugging the housewives, or I say, you know, and the convicts hugging the cops, you know, and every, you know, and the bikers, you know, that were recovering heroin addicts and alcoholics that should be well off dead long time ago, actually sober, crying, talking about God. They still cuss. You can cuss and say God and like say praise, man. I was home. I fell in love. But it was too new to me. It was too new to me. So my first meeting, that's what I saw. When we talk about the light in the eyes and stuff like that, I saw that. But it was still too, it was too new, and I was too fresh off the streets. And my head was still saying, you know, I talk about assuming the position. Because we got in there and we said the Lord's Prayer, which I didn't even know, and okay, whatever. I just crossed my arms, and it was just like, you know, don't touch me. You know, my pride and my fear just got me. You know, for that brief moment, it was just like, I had to, in order to, you know, get into this thing, I had to make a choice to not let that put a wall between me and you. You know, I had to say, You know, that worked for me out there. You know, that was a design for living that worked for me out there. And there are some things that I took in here from the streets that still serve me. I am tenacious. I, you know, someone, Harry, this guy, Harry T, I call him Uncle Harry, Hippie Harry. You know, I understood Harry. He was a recovering pot-smoking, heroin-shooting, acid-dropping alcoholic, and I just love Harry. He was real. We're Birkenstocks. Harry's not sober today, but I remember after we used to have these big, huge young people's meetings on Saturday night or on Sunday nights at 400 West Campbell here in Campbell. And after a meeting one night, I was walking to my car, and he pulled me. He was walking to his, and he grabbed me, and he pulled me aside, and he looked me right in the eye, and he said, "You have a healthy desperation for the program, kid, and don't ever lose it. Don't ever lose it." You know, and Harry's not sober today, but I am, by the grace of God. And I am desperate, and I hope you're desperate. I really do, because sometimes, at least in my experience, especially right now, you know, that's the thing that keeps me going no matter what. But that design for living that I came in with, for the most part, I exchanged for the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was not a good student. When I came in here and they told me I needed to read the big book and work the steps and write an inventory, I was willing. I was real willing. From the gate, you know. From the moment I was brought to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous by my aunt. She had about 5 or 6 years at that time. And I wasn't sure what was going on with her, but I do remember that she used to sell dope and use it, and her life was crazy. And then somehow it was getting better, and, you know, and I wasn't sure, but I just remember, you know, the day that I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, it wasn't a burning bush. I hadn't been to jail, not for myself. You know, it wasn't like that. I was just going, and I was going to cop some dope and from a friend of mine's mom. And instead of going to downtown San Jose like I'd usually done, I drove past that exit, and I kept driving to her house. And all I knew is I was sitting in her living room, and she didn't ask me anything. I sat there, and I said, you know what, I'm in trouble. I'm in trouble. And she at that time was working on an adolescent rehab unit. She worked on quite a few of them, actually. And she just kind of looked at me, this kid, you know, and she just laughed. I said, no, you don't understand. I need help. I didn't ask for help. You never ask for help. I said, no, I have a real problem. She says, I know, Tammy, I've been watching you for a while. She said, she says, if you're interested, I can take you to a place where there are people like you that can help you. And that's when I uttered what I believe to be my first sober word. My first sober breath was yes. And when we got to the meeting, and after the meeting, she asked me if I wanted to sign up for a temporary sponsor. I said yes. And when I was assigned to a sponsor, and I made a commitment to meet with her, I said yes, and I showed up. And I remember standing at the foot of her condo, it was these stairs, and I just remember going, man, I don't know what I'm getting myself into. But I climbed those stairs and knocked on her door. I didn't even know. She was a friend of my aunt. She is still sober today. My aunt is also not sober today. I can tell you more people who are not sober, amazingly. She opened the door. Man, she was gorgeous. She's still here. Cecilia. Tall, brunette, she's 33, brunette hair down to here, just 6 feet, working. No. She's seeing you, she's working out, and I mean, she opened that door, and I'm just this cute. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous wearing combat boots and camouflage and white undershirt tank top, and people talked about that, and I don't remember that. But she opened that door up, and man, and she wore suits to work. Yeah. And I'm sitting there, I'm 18 years old, and I'm just like, damn, she has what I want. And so she took me through the steps. So getting to this, she took me through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And for those of you who are new and wondering what the hell you're doing here, you know, what to do here, I said yes to these steps. And I said yes to taking these steps. And I said yes when she gave me direction to take these steps. But I'm happy to report that you can stay sober even if you don't understand the steps. Even if you don't, I didn't understand. I took a third step. Okay.
Okay.
I wrote a fourth step. Okay. But I didn't understand what the hell I was doing. Powerless over alcohol and my life was unmanageable. No, excuse me. I didn't get the luxury of that before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had to experience powerlessness over alcohol and unmanageability after I got sober. I still go there so often. You know, my life fell apart after I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I started losing jobs. I going broke, winded up on couches, just craziness. I put my fist through my windshield in my little $35 Volkswagen after a 6 o'clock meeting because I was just dying in my skin. I was just pissed. Y'all look, suddenly these people with the glow in their eyes, man, I wanted to kill them. So how did you get that? How did you get there? You know what I mean? And man, one day just, you know, it got real. And that's what it's about. It's not about looking good here. This is just for me. It's about, for me, showing up, oftentimes, just bleeding. You know, just the required, one of the prices of admission for staying sober for me was being willing to grow up. Therefore, I have been around in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, growing up for the last 11 years, not knowing, just not knowing. But practicing and practicing and practicing these views. And I'm sitting there and I'm just like, all I had written was the same old game that I had played out there, the lines, you know, about being a welfare child growing up and my family being, you know, I just put that all, you know, the spiel that I came up with out there to get me what I wanted. Another extension on the welfare checks or another opportunity to stay in school, get out from getting expelled, which I wound up doing anyways, all that. I just put that down on paper. Oh, I know what that, oh, okay, I'll put that down. Well, when we sat down, you know, she looked at me, and I got maybe half page down. And she stopped me, and she said, that's good, honey, but, you know, I need to stop you right now, because what we need to look at is how those things made you feel. You know, what I heard was, you know, feel. It's like, it just echoed in my head, and I was like, wait, no, I don't do feelings. In fact, I do anything to not do feelings. I don't. I run, I use, I drink, I fight, I scream, I yell, I do anything, but I don't feel. You know, and that's when it got really real for me, and I got to see that this thing, what this thing was all about. So, I kicked and screamed, and eventually I got my second four step out. That was after I had shredded my big book. Man, put my... It's crazy. You can do that and not take anything. That's why I share that with you, in case anyone wants to do that. I met a woman today. She's got about four or five years. She busted a whole stack of dishes this morning in her kitchen. My sponsor, who has 23 years, she and I sat with this woman at lunch and said, right on. Good for you, you know, because she's thawing out. And this is where we get positioned so that we can get to the other side and get free of those things. And those things will no longer have that kind of power. you know, the things that I came in to Alcoholics Anonymous with, the resentments, the fears, the guilt, you know, I got to heal here, and they don't. We have a saying, I got David Neal, who's still around, he got sober when he was 15 years old, and he was here when I came to Saturday Night Live. He taught me this phrase early in sobriety. He said, his phrase is, live free or die. And the truth is you get an opportunity to do that through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what it was given me. That's been my experience. You know, we talk about defects of character and asking him to remove our shortcomings. I didn't understand what those were. I didn't even understand defects of character. I didn't even get that phrase. I had to, like, look it up in a dictionary. And after I did my fifth step, what I thought was I was supposed to do, what I did was I sat in my room for 3 days. I didn't go to a meeting. At the foot of my bed, reading my 12 and 12, waiting for God to come right down and remove my key defects of character. I just thought they just, I didn't even know what they were. Well, finally, I mean, I was just crazy. 3 days of not going to meetings in early sobriety is not a good idea. If you're new here, I'm going to encourage you to get into good AA habits. You know, and to me, what that was taught, to you know, what those were when I came here is you go to a meeting, you know, 90 meetings, 90 days, you know, and you get phone numbers and you get into service. And you go to step study meetings. The way I got this program, when it turned out finally, the way I got this program was mostly through step study and big book meetings, where I got to hear you sharing what this was about and then getting with my sponsor. And to wrap this up, I guess I just want to share with you what it's like today. When I got on that plane today, I still suffer from negative thinking. I really do. That's what character defect is in my face today, to be, you know, to be looked at. And I didn't think, you know, and I was not in a place to, I know it's hot in here, isn't it? It's going to get hotter. No. I was just in this really, you know, I couldn't share with you what it's like today and all the good stuff, but I got on this plane and I was late, and I got to the back of the plane. It seemed like there was the only seats that were open were between two guys. Good AA habits. Women stick with the women, and men stick with the men. You know. But I was looking at this plane, and finally I wound up in the way back with this man and this woman, and asked if I could sit there, and the woman moved over. And I just looked at these two, and there was just something about them. And I asked them, and I realized they were married. You know, and I'm married today, 4 years, been with them 7, and I am absolutely clueless how to be a wife. Price of admission for me in Alcoholics Anonymous is to be willing to grow up. And that's just another part of me that says, I don't want to grow up. I don't want to grow up. You know, I got to learn how to be a wife, got to close that back door on my marriage. You know, you keep that nice and safe. Guess what? It's a commitment. But these two, I said, how long have you been married? And they said, 1 year. He said, but he had been married 44 years before that, and she was married 38. And they just talked about all the they were so in love with each other, and that's what they talked about. This is the greatest thing, gift, you know, and she's just showered in diamonds, which impressed me. He gave me this, and he did this for me, and they're just sharing on and on, and I'm getting all these, I said, man, I got a good vibe from you. She was reading this book, and she had a bookmark in it, and before, next thing you know, she says, you got to count your blessings every day. That's what my sponsor talks about. My sponsor talks about is you got to go with this thing every day like you know nothing about recovery. Not recovery, but you just got to go at it. Keep it simple. You know, stay with the basics. So, you know, that's what, you know, I'm doing today. And I have a lot. What I have today, and what's important for me to share before I sit down is this. I was sharing with this young gal this afternoon. If you're young or whatever here, if this thing wasn't fun, if there wasn't a sufficient substitute that was offered through this program to the way I was living my life and what I was getting from my life before I got here, I can guarantee you I would never have stuck around for 11 years. I'm a bright girl. I can tell when somebody's running a number or telling a lie or playing a game with me. And what I get today is people in my life who are genuine and who love me, who welcome me home. Went to San Diego, didn't work out. My home is here. I have a home. My husband and I left for San Diego. We had a going away party. There was 170 people there. I am overpaid. I am overpaid. And if this thing wasn't fun, 18, 19, through those years, I wouldn't have stuck around. There's good news, folks. If you come here looking for misery, you will find it. If you come here looking for the joy of living, we offer it freely. If you're willing to do the work and you don't quit 5 minutes before the miracle, which we tell you often here, I'm here to report the rest of the story. My experience when my ass has absolutely fallen off in this program and I have chosen not to pick up anything no matter what, that includes watching my mother die right in front of me. That includes having to make the decision to let her go. You know, that was the hardest thing that happened to me. She's 47 years old and she died in one day and we still don't know why. And when she was dropping below a point where they had to make a decision whether to bring her back or not, and the room was packed full of people and it was packed full of strangers and it was packed full of doctors and everyone looked up and they turned. And they, for a decision to be made, whether to try, you know, what to do with her, they looked at me. And because of the healing that had happened with her and I and our relationship as a direct result of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, making direct amends to such people wherever possible and living to the best of my ability to be the best daughter and make a living amends to her, I was able to look them in the eye, trust the God of my understanding, and let her go. And I will tell you, if you don't quit 5 minutes before the miracle, the rest of the story is you get a miracle. I'm done. I'm overpaid. Thanks for letting me share.